How much fun was that escape room the other night?
It was fun, but we definitely solved it before we even got there.
Yeah, but what's funny is we solved it before we got there, but then didn't solve the room. Like, solved the clue, the final clue, but didn't solve the actual room.
So, listeners, we went to an escape room the other night, and it was Jack the Ripper themed, and he definitely got us.
Yeah, but Melissa's like, I think it was H.H. Holmes who was actually Jack the Ripper. The final clue was Jack, there was H.H. Holmes. We just couldn't find the pieces to put it together. We knew the answer. We couldn't
really
find
it. It was really hard, but it was fun.
We were victims, but I got to lock Melissa in a cage, so.
It's true.
All of you, you're welcome.
Just collectively.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet. Or so we're claiming.
We think.
I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my partner in true crime, my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
What's up?
Melissa, we are on episode number 40, and that means 40 straight weeks of content. Can you believe? I'm so proud of us.
That's so wild. It does not feel like it's been 40 weeks.
Feels like it's been 400 weeks, if you're being honest. But 40 internet weeks. Well, this is also our final week of February, which one, I can't believe February is over already. It's 2025. Yeah. Like, where is it going?
I have no idea.
And also, that means the end of our block, Fairy Tale or Romance Fails. And I haven't heard a lot of fairy tales. Maybe they started that way, but they didn't end that way.
Yeah, I feel like it should have just been called Romance Fail.
Skip the fairy tale part.
Exactly. So scratch that fairy tale. We'll just call it Romance Fail for Block 10. And you know what? My case today is absolutely no exception, of course. So should we get straight into it?
Let's do it. Absolutely. But before we do, let's remind folks, a like, a subscribe, a comment, anything, a review would be so immensely helpful. We just like to kind of remind everybody, if you're liking what you're hearing and appreciate the 40 weeks of straight content, no misses, we would really appreciate a little click in return. So would go a long way.
Yeah, pretty please.
Anyway, now we may get into it.
All right. Well, it is Labor Day weekend in 2004, and we're in Nantucket, Massachusetts, and 44-year-old Elizabeth Lochtfeld, who goes by Bess, she hears her phone ringing from inside her cottage. So she goes in, she answers the phone, and there's an excited voice on the line that says, "Come over and meet the man you're gonna marry."
Whoa.
I know. So Beth smiles as she recognizes the voice immediately as one of her friends, Bernadette Mannix Feeney. Beth and Bernadette had met the year prior to this at a charity event. So that Labor Day weekend, Bernadette introduced tall, smart, successful, and beautiful Beth to tall, smart, and handsome 37-year-old Tom Tulin.
See, sounds like a fairy tale.
I know. So Bernadette had known Tom since he was a kid, and she couldn't imagine like anyone better for her friend Beth. Unfortunately, though, matchmaking was decidedly not Bernadette's forte, because by Halloween of that same year, one of the members of this, air quotes, perfect couple would be dead, and the other one would spend the rest of his or her life in prison.
I like the mystery where we don't know who it's going to be. Unless it's the guy, then it's like, huh.
Spoiler alert. But before we get into that, Ed, have you ever been to the island of Nantucket?
I have not. I knew a girl from there.
Did you?
That's about it.
All right. Well, it is a small island off the coast of Cape Cod, both of which are in Massachusetts. And they're hugely popular in the summer. Like, we have these picturesque towns and beaches. Think of the beach in the movie Jaws, minus the killer shark.
Yeah. You're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah. But like very, you know, very New England. It's super adorable.
There's rocks, a lot of rocks more than usual.
Yes, a lot of rocks. But it's just like these cute little seaside towns dotted with lighthouses and sandy beaches. And it's just beautiful. So there's a little over 14,000 residents who live on Nantucket like all year round. But apparently during the summer, this little island can play host to thousands of people. I actually saw somewhere about 60,000 people per summer.
Wow. Now that reminds me of Jaws, because remember all those people would flock for 4th of July, and that's why they didn't want to close the beaches.
Exactly. And I mean, that's just like, it's especially wild when you consider that the island's only about 48 square miles. So it's not very big. I looked up the average home cost in Nantucket in 2024.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, it's ridiculous. So Zillow said it was in like the $2.7 million range, but Realtor.com was in the $4.7 million range. So we're going to split the difference and say the houses are $3.7 million.
Oh, that's through Melissa's website?
Yes, that's what Melissa.com says.
Don't go to that website, people. I urge you.
I urge you not to. That's just going to be spam pop-up after spam pop-up. Nantucket is super fancy. It's elegant. It's sophisticated. It's very old money. Mm. And it's a quiet island, but it's also safe. Or at least it was until Monday, October 25th, 2004. And that day, the island saw its first homicide in over 20 years. And it's been 20 years now since this murder, and I don't think Nantucket has really ever been the same. I feel like I don't even know if they can recover from what happened.
It doesn't sound like the kind of place where overly bad things happen. Often, at
exactly.
Least.
I mean, we'll see at the end. The one officer, this is the first homicide he's ever worked. That's wild.
It's the limitations that puts on police departments. We've seen it, and it happens all the time. Like, small agencies don't always have the tools.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one's not too much of a whodunit, but just an FYI on my sources, I did watch a Dateline episode entitled "Murder in Nantucket." And there's an episode on their podcast of the same thing, but that one's called Fatal Attraction. And then I did rely heavily on a book about the case called Safe Harbor, A Murder in Nantucket by Brian McDonald. And that was written shortly after the murder. So even the trial's not in it. It was very much about the members and our couple and their lives and like what they had been through and how they got to where they were. So back to Nantucket, I want to tell you about the homes at 1 Hawthorne Lane, which is where a horrific massacre on this idyllic little island is going to take place. So this home and another home on the property were, or maybe still are, owned by a woman by the name of Barbara Kodalak. She's a woman, I would say she's about her 60s or so. She's a lifelong Nantucketer. So like I said, it's Monday, October 25th, 2004. It's about quarter of noon, and Barbara's outside. She's tending to her garden. And all of a sudden, she sees a red Ford Explorer come up her driveway and park. And I do want to make note that there's not a whole lot of Ford Explorers cruising around the island. We're talking, there's generally more higher-end cars. So this stood out especially to Barbara.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so she curiously looks up from her gardening to see a very well-dressed, youngish man standing outside of the car. Barbara would later say he was dressed like a New Yorker. So the man was very handsome. He had like this slicked back blonde hair, and it was slicked back as if he were like channeling his inner Gordon Gekko.
Oh man, Michael Douglas.
Yes.
Was at Wall Street. Do you know he got tongue cancer from... Did you hear about that going down on Catherine
Zeta-Jones? Stop. Don't say that. That's not
he
how.
He said that. He said that. It most certainly is how.
She's gorgeous. I'd risk it.
Oh, yeah. Worth it. Totally worth it.
Totally worth it. Well, this young man, while he carried himself with confidence, something seemed like a little bit off to Barbara. She was getting some yucky vibes. So she didn't recognize this man, and once he saw her cautiously staring at him, he turned to her and in a very deep, like, baritone voice, the man gestured toward the rental cottage and asked if anyone was there. And again, Barbara feels more and more uneasy, so she just kind of shrugs and says, I don't know. Even though, like, both of them can clearly see that the renter's vehicle's in the driveway.
That's creepy.
Yeah. So let's talk about Barbara's renter. She was renting her guest house to 44-year-old Elizabeth, who went by Beth, Lochtfeld. In addition to renting the cottage, Beth also owned a beautiful apartment in Greenwich Village in New York City, which she was currently subletting. Beth was wildly successful and incredibly wealthy thanks to her hard work. She had just sold her company for millions of dollars. Wow. And she had started this company in her bedroom like 20 years earlier. And she literally built this company from the ground up. And it became such a success that she was able to sell it and retire before she even hit 45. That's insane.
Wow, that's badass. What kind of company was it?
Okay, so she owned Code Inc., and it was like an architectural code consulting and expediting firm.
What?
So, yeah. Basically, they would help architects and like construction project people on what all those building codes meant in New York City. Because apparently. And like, so they taught you how to follow them. Just basically get all the permits that you need for any work you're going to do. Because apparently New York is like brutal with building codes and permits and whatever else.
I'm sure.
So this is a hard business to get in. There's a lot of stuff you need to know. And apparently, kind of before Beth came along, her competitors were a little bit rough. This was heavy in, like, the mob. The mob were doing a lot of these businesses. Yeah. So here comes Beth, and, you know, but she did not allow herself to be intimidated, and it was like everything she touched just turned to green, lots of money.
Good for her. I'm so far away from retirement, it's not even funny.
You're actually going backwards.
I'm going to be 103, according to the government.
Exactly. So Beth really kind of almost like reinvented how this industry worked. A lot of things were real kind of shady cash deals before she came along. And you know what? She was like, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to run an honest business. So a lot of these architects working for higher end clients, they wanted to work with Beth because she was, you know, upstanding and she wasn't breaking any laws. And Beth was so good at what she did that she managed to find every damn loophole to get her clients what they wanted, but legally.
That's like, awesome.
She just had such a knack for, she was a fixer, basically. Yeah.
Sounds like she did it the right way, too.
She definitely did. So Beth's favorite quote was said by William the Conqueror, and it read, quote, "You don't have to succeed to persevere." End quote. So I had to Google, like, what does this quote mean? But what, Ed, does this quote mean to you?
I don't know. I mean, I just listening to that, it hits kind of close to home because I feel like that's us sometimes. And obviously we're not on pace with William the Conqueror, but like we probably put another 40 hours a week into this podcast and have such like a small niche following, but we've interviewed cops and families and authors and psychologists. I mean, Ted Bundy's cousin. That's what I mean. So like everyone has such a positive experience when they work with us. So I feel like all of this work we're doing, although it hasn't exactly been recognized on a big scale yet, it's so rewarding what we're doing. So that's, I guess, we're reaching the right people, you know? So I guess that's what that quote would, how I would interpret it.
I like agree. I agree with you. Like what you said, that's, you know, exact. I thought of the podcast as well when I read that quote. So in 2002, when Beth was just ready for some calm, because she had been working since she was 14. So at this point, she's 42. She's like, I can retire. So she felt ready for some calm. It was more pseudo retirement, but so she decided that she was going to sell her company, and she ended up getting a substantial amount of money. And that's when she decided she wanted to spend her time in Nantucket. And Beth loved Nantucket. From the moment she stepped on that island when she was a child, she felt like it was where she belonged. In the Safe Harbor book, the author wrote a very, it's a really beautiful quote. He said, "Nantucket, in its elegance and perfection, was a place where Beth's dreams had formed. It was part of her soul. More than anything else, perhaps, Beth wanted the stars over Nantucket Harbor to light her wedding night." End quote.
Wow.
She just felt at home there. That's like where her soul found the most peace. And she felt that she belonged there, and she felt so safe there. Beth was a 10 out of 10 in every single aspect of life, except one. And that was love. So at the time of our story, Beth was 44 years old, and she's ready to settle down. And, you know, she's beginning to wonder if she had missed her opportunity for love and a husband and a family and a white picket fence, which is why the day, that Labor Day weekend, when she received the call from Bernadette, Beth jumped at the chance to finally meet her Mr. Perfect, a man by the name of Thomas Toulin III. All right, let's talk about old Tommy. Tom was the second child born to Dolores and John on July 31st, 1967. They lived in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, and according to the book, this was like a nicer neighborhood than the rest of Brooklyn. I'm not familiar with Brooklyn.
I'm not either.
Yeah. So while Tom was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth, his parents did find substantial financial success during his early childhood. Tom's mom basically opened like the first private school in their area. So it was super popular and became super well respected. And yeah, Tom's dad found success in the world of real estate. So thanks to Tom's parents' hard work, he was able to attend a private school in New York City. And like, obviously his family had money, but not to the extent as many of his classmates. So Tom liked the finer things in life, and so did Beth. The difference, however, was that Beth was ready and willing to work her ass off to be part of like the Nantucketer world. Tom, not so much. He didn't have that drive, he didn't have work ethic. And in a scary comparison, he struck me very much like Bundy, like where he kind of would hang on the coattails and live vicariously through other successes. Like, remember Ted invited Stephanie to like meet his aunt and uncle, and it was like he was kind of like bragging about that their family. Yes, like a good example. Tom would like brag about how he was friends with the owners of the Mets baseball team, and he would sit in his personal box, blah, blah, blah. And like, yeah, Tom did sit in the owner's personal box, but the box and the connections to the owner were because Tom's friend's rich dad was friends with the guy.
Oh, see, I do that all the time though. Like, I gotta go somewhere super important. You're like, yeah, I know the president. It's fine. And it turns out the 14 connections I had to make to get that seat.
Well, that's basically what Tom did. And as the author of the Safe Harbor book wrote, quote, "Tom Toulin would grow up in an atmosphere of intense social climbing," end quote. Which I think says a lot and is especially prevalent now, like with the social media, where you can kind of show off whatever life you want.
It's true. It's like, isn't that like a scary kind of comparison to Ted Bundy?
It is. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, as I was reading about this guy, I was like, he's an 80s villain, first of all. But second of all,
I see you've made it past my top men. And he brushes his hair back.
He literally is like, just wait until you hear about his outfits and everything. He's like a 1980s, like Wall Street villain.
Oh, I can't wait.
Tom tended to really coast through life, like committing infractions that were just never dealt with. Like, his parents and their society standing, that was his safety net. And as his mom's school, like, grew more popular, the family moved into this upscale apartment building at 35 Prospect Park West. And it was here that Tom Tulin would meet the Mannix family and befriend Jimmy Mannix, who they were about the same age. And the Mannix family is uber-duber wealthy. Like, Jimmy and, by extension, Tom were even driven to school in a limo.
Wow.
Yeah, and Mr. Mannix was actually the guy I talked about earlier who, like, was friends with the Mets owner.
Okay, well, yeah, why does that name sound so familiar, Mannix?
Maybe from the beginning of the story Bernadette Mannix Feeney set Beth and Tom up. So Bernadette was the older sister of Jimmy, so I think she was, like, 4 years older than him and Tom. And side note, the only person to blame here is the murderer. However, this woman had known Tom since he was a child, which meant she knew about most of his antics, which we'll get more into, but kind of left me wondering what kind of friend would set anybody up with Tom's
woman. Yeah.
Yeah. So when Tom was younger, he was, like, never really the kindest child. But things got worse as he got older. Like, at the age of 13, he began drinking alcohol.
Wow. That's so young.
Yeah. Yeah. And this would be literally the biggest mistake of his life. And it would lead to addiction issues for, like, the next couple decades. And as if drinking heavily at the age of 13, like, daily drinking, wasn't bad enough, his first drink also, like, coincided with his sexual awakening, if you will, because one day Tom and a friend, another 13-year-old, they're at this bar and they were served, and Tom suddenly realized a couple things. The first thing was that vodka made you feel really nice.
It's true.
And it also, you know, gives you some confidence.
Also true.
Exactly. And the other thing he noticed were some women dancing in the bar, and suddenly, Tom is feeling like the man, and he wanted to be with one of those women.
That's a recipe for disaster, I think, the fact that he's having his, like, sexual awakening when he's also discovering booze, too, because now he's going to link those two things together for his entire life, and that's bad news. No good.
Oh, it's really bad. So Tom would pretty much struggle with alcoholism from that day forward. He did try rehab multiple times. He tried group therapy. And when I say he tried, I really mean he went to those places.
He showed up.
Yeah. But did he try?
It's like when you used to go to church by yourself, but you just, like, sneak in and grab a bulletin so you can prove you were there and then just go to the arcade or something.
Totally there. Yeah, I feel like Tom was kind of pulling that. I think there was a part of him that did want to get on the straight and narrow, but, like, there was a bigger part of him who just wanted to be the life of the party.
Sure.
So Tom went to a private high school, and he was in several extracurriculars, including the French club, the student newspaper, and even the drama club. And I feel like those acting classes definitely contributed to his later ickiness, let's say.
He's dramatic.
So while Tom's parents were, like, intelligent academics, and his sister Tara was super bright, she went to Yale and was, like, top of her class, Tom just kind of coasted through high school. He did enough to pass, but, like, never really tried to be anything more than mediocre. So when Tom was, I think, a junior in high school, he was blessed with the opportunity to spend 6 weeks in France.
Wow.
It was in France, however, that he went from just mean to, like, downright vicious and cruel.
Wow.
Like, yeah, he had always been an, air quotes, prankster. Like, he actually packed stink bombs in his luggage to France, but everything else was,
what,
like,
is he, five?
Exactly. Like, but this was different.
Next to his fart machine.
Right. And his whoopee cushion. Yeah. All that stuff.
Exactly.
Well, on the flight over to France, Tom started drinking, and that never really stopped. And he was super duper intoxicated, like, for the majority of the trip. And like when he was drunk, he was an evil, evil human. And he took his anger out on women. There's multiple stories, and a lot of these happened in France, but they would happen later on as well. He grabbed a woman, handcuffed her to a car door, and peed on her.
I'm guessing she didn't ask for that.
No.
Oh, okay.
He also jokingly pretended to throw a girl out of a hot air balloon to the point that one of his friends was legitimately scared at the look in his eyes.
Wow.
He would go up to women on the French streets who were sex workers and just start like yelling the French word for like, you are dirty.
So like degrading.
Just being mean. And when he would hook up with these French sex workers, he just spent the whole time like ruthlessly degrading them.
That's terrible. So that's something inside him, that there's some evil villain living in his head that's his escape.
100%. He's vicious. Wow. So when Tom gets back to the United States, his behavior just gets worse. He was constantly drunk. He would go to a bar or restaurant, drink excessively, and then run out on the tab. He pulled this all the time. He did it with cabbies. He would get a cab ride home. Then he would say, oh, my wallet's upstairs. And then he would just like peace out. And of course, his doorman is going to stand up for him, not for the cabbie. Like, right. He did this on a nightly basis. He would drunkenly harass elderly people as they walked down the sidewalk. Like, he was just a fucking menace.
What are his parents doing about all this?
That's a very good question. We really don't know. My guess is, and this is 100% speculation, my opinion, I feel like they were either ignoring it or chalking it up to boys will be boys kind of mentality.
That reaches a limit, though, where like excuse works up to a point. And I feel like he's crossed that point.
Oh, the stories that I read about him were so beyond foul. So by the time he graduated, he had quite a few school suspensions under his belt. And over the next few years, he would just proceed to enroll in like highly prestigious universities to just then drop out or be kicked out within a few months. And this entire time, his alcoholism is getting worse and worse. And now he's experimenting with drugs like LSD and whatever pills he could get his grubby little mitts on. So during this short time while he was enrolled in college, he was pulling the same shit he pulled in France, including his fondness of urinating on women.
Like Chuck Berry.
Ugh, yeah. Foul. So, like I mentioned earlier, I still don't really understand why Bernadette insisted on this love connection, because...
Yeah, some friend.
Yeah, like she had to have known what a douchebag he was. Like,
yeah.
And she definitely knew he had a drink. She's on the Dateline episode and she goes, and this is like literally a quote, "I knew he had a drinking problem, but regardless, I know a million people with a drinking problem." Bro.
Yeah, and they're never fun to be around, like unless you're really drunk too.
I don't even think you could be drunk enough to have fun with this Tom the tool bag.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So like I can understand maybe her not knowing everything, but there's no way she could have been ignorant to this next stunt that he pulled. It's Christmas of 1985, and Tom is hanging out with Jimmy, his best friend, Bernadette's little brother. And Santa had given Jimmy a fancy schmancy new bright red car for Christmas.
Like a car?
A car, yeah.
Wow.
A legitimate car. So Tom asks to borrow it, and Jimmy's like, and Tom's like, come on, bro. So Jimmy gives in. Tom stole this vehicle and drove away and didn't return for 7 months.
What was he doing for 7 months with his dude's car?
Following the Grateful Dead and indulging in all sorts of drug-induced chaos. So.
I can get behind that. Dude, give me your car. I'll see you in 7 months.
The car was never seen again. And nothing happened because Jimmy's dad was way too much of a class act to like embarrass his like friends, like Tom's parents.
He's a douchebag.
He's such a douchebag. I will say that maybe for once in his life, his parents came down on him a little bit. I don't really know. And the author of the book really didn't know. But all that was said was that he somehow got his shit together enough to enroll in Columbia University. And he did graduate in 1991. Although from most accounts, it did sound like he was drinking from the time he woke up until the time he passed out every night.
God, it boggles my mind that some people can function like that. I guess that's part of the whole illness, you know?
Right. No, I agree. But I do think it's important to remember, and again, my personal opinion, but the rules, including those about, you know, meeting requirements for getting into college, I feel like they don't always apply to you when you can, you know, write a check with lots of zeros.
That's so usually true.
If I had to guess how he got in and stayed in. But anyway, after college, Tom had spent some time in Atlanta working as a used car salesman, which just fits him so well.
Oh, 100%.
But then he got a job at Smith Barney, which is now Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. Big Wall Street money, blah, blah, blah. I still don't really get it. But we're pretty sure he only got that job because apparently there was someone by the name of Jack Toulon who worked there. So little Nepo baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, after just a few weeks, he was let go due to getting in a drunken brawl with one of his managers.
I figure that was only a matter of time.
Oh, yeah. So he then returned home to New York City. He ended up getting a job with, I believe it was called AST, and they were some sort of financial institution. Well, he did okay there, but then the guy went to sell it, and he sold it to Smith Barney, and Smith Barney is like, we do not want this guy back. Like, are you kidding me? And the guy who was selling the company was like, well, then no deal. Like, I'm taking all my employees, which makes me think of The Office when Ryan like defrauded the company and then like he gets to come back because of Michael Scott Paper. I was like, is he Ryan Howard? What is happening?
What's happening here?
Like, this guy just keeps getting like break after break. Wow. But
I think it was some greased wheels.
Oh, 100%. So in early 2001, Tom is at this like super fancy schmancy Park Avenue antique auction kind of event. And of course he's drunk. So this fucking moron decides to steal a 60-pound marble bust of like, I don't know, a conqueror king or somebody important. And this thing is worth over 80 grand. So this drunken dumbass picks it up and shoves it under his jacket.
Oh, the old pig in a blanket. Classic.
Like, security was awesome. Like, are you kidding me? And it just so happened that a New York Daily News reporter just like happened to be there and like catch wind of all this. Oh, and the next day it splashed all over the newspapers. And at this point, the Smith Barney people are like, yeah. You are way too problematic for us. Here's a severance. Here's some money. Have a good one.
We're going to need you to collect your things.
Yeah. And that's pretty much like how all of Tom's jobs went. But yet again, he didn't get in trouble because due to like avoiding embarrassment and bad press, like from the antique people, I guess, they let him plead out to disorderly conduct. So he got 10 days of community service.
Oh, really? Really hit him hard. It's now your earlier statement about the Nantucket elite is kind of making sense.
Mm-hmm. And my guess is that the community is still waiting to be serviced by Tom Toulon. So during all these years, Tom is like carefully crafting his image. He like boasted to people about his job and his title, and he led people to believe that he's like pulling in $500,000. And he always dressed the part. Like, he's always in this double-breasted suit. Sometimes he had an ascot. He would have a, I know, he would wear pocket square and shiny loafers with like the tassels, the whole nine yards. He would often add a fedora and like a long camel hair coat.
Wow.
Douche.
Looks like a chic.
Such a freaking loser. And Beth, actually, when they got together, she was like, yeah, he's a poser. Like, she knew it.
But she knew it, yeah.
She, you know, she felt like that was something she could get over. So Tom just bragged about everything. And there would be times where he would, like, tell people he hadn't been in a while because he was skiing in the French, Swiss, whatever, Alps. The or Alps. Making up all these stories. And meanwhile, the bartender would be like, dude, I just saw you at, like, X restaurant the other day. Yeah. And he'd be like, oh, so he is just trying to make himself out to be somebody he's not. And, of course, he loved the ladies. And I think that he loved bragging about the ladies even more than he liked having a girlfriend.
Oh.
At the local bar he frequented, people said his catchphrase was, so there's this chick I'm banging.
I know guys like this. They're the worst. They're so greasy.
Gross. Yeah. Just slimy. The one bar owner of the bar that he frequented made a really interesting comment. It was something along the lines of, he knew everybody, but I never saw him with anybody.
Yep. I know that guy.
Yep. So over the next few years, Tom would work for Citibank, Mellon Bank, like all the freaking banks, and inevitably get fired. But by the time he was introduced to Beth, nobody really knows what Tom was doing to finance his extravagant lifestyle and excessive alcohol consumption. Like, at one point, Beth took him to meet her brother, Tom. And when brother Tom asked Tommy Toolbag what he did for a living, the only response he could get was a consultant. Which
working on a big deal. Closing a big deal.
Exactly. Closing a big deal that I'm consulting with the big deal.
And all the red flag words, all the trigger words.
Exactly. I feel like that's when you're like, I'm an entrepreneur.
Yes. I'm between gigs.
Yeah. Well, when it came to Tom's love life, he definitely didn't have a hard time getting women, but keeping them was another story. One woman he stayed with for a while was, her name was Jessica. And when Tom was sober, it really was a fairy tale, but that just never lasted long. Like, Jessica quickly got tired of hitting the bar scene every night and just, you know, having to watch Tom become a cruel drunken fool every single night. And one night they had been out, and when they got home, they both went to bed. Well, unbeknownst to Jessica, Tom couldn't sleep, so he decided to snoop in her belongings. Well, in her wallet, he found like a random old business card from an ex-boyfriend of hers. He lost his shit. He stormed out of the apartment, down to the corner bar, and proceeded to just get absolutely hammered out of his friggin' mind. And, you know, Jessica's asleep, whatever, she has no idea this is going on. Then she is violently ripped out of her slumber by Tom sitting on top of her, choking her.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And she couldn't scream. She couldn't breathe. She eventually stopped fighting and like let herself go limp, which that was the only way that Tom loosened his grip around her throat. But like,
what the hell's this dude's problem? He's got a fragile little male ego, I think. Oh,
absolutely. Like, he definitely has that energy.
Mm-hmm.
But Jessica would talk about, like, even though he stopped trying to choke her, like, the look of absolute hatred in his eyes would just haunt her for years.
We've heard how many times it's like they flip a switch.
Yes. And that was basically Tom in a nutshell, like a Jekyll and Hyde. Wow. So Jessica ended things with Tom, but he's like a professional con man. He love bombed the hell out of her. And he eventually was able to talk her into giving him another chance. But she said, under one condition, sobriety.
Fair.
Absolutely. And for several months, he did stop drinking. He went to AA meetings. He stayed out of the bars. He was honestly, for the first time, really living his best life.
Wow.
However,
it's good. It's good to hear. I wish it would. I wish that would stay that way.
Exactly. Like, you wish that would have stuck. But I mean, Jessica couldn't forget the night he had tried to literally kill her.
Yeah.
And after yet another night of verbal abuse from Tom, where he was just being nasty to her for the sake of being nasty, she broke things off for good. And he did try his love bombing bullshit like he always did, but this time it didn't work. And Jessica even had to have Tom like banned from her building.
Good. I'm glad she did something about it.
Me too. There was another woman who actually jumped out of a cab to run away from him. That's how terrifying good. He was.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I'm glad these women escaped before. I'm assuming something bad happens here.
Yeah.
Just given what we do for a living.
Unfortunately. Well, after the breakup with Jessica, it didn't take long for Tom to forget about sobriety and pick up the drink again. And it would be only a few days like later that he would meet Beth, and so many people's lives would be changed. So now that you have a little bit of who Tom and Beth are, now it's time to talk about the two of them together. So we're kind of back to where we started, the phone call from Bernadette to Beth on Labor Day weekend 2004. Come right over and meet your future husband, blah, blah, blah.
I like the way you brought it back.
Thank
brought it back
you.
To the story. Yeah, it's a nice tie. It comes right back to where we started.
Comes right back. So Beth is excited after this phone call, and Tom was excited too. And apparently upon their first meeting, the chemistry between them was absolutely electric. It really was. So they seem to have a lot in common. They shared like many of the same values. And they just seemed really perfect for each other. And for the first few weeks, the relationship really was perfect. It moved incredibly fast, but it was still really good. And I guess, like, even though it was moving fast, like, it felt right. And I guess sometimes you just know.
That's all that matters.
Right. So, and they had a great time. You know, they went to the opera. They went to museum openings and art exhibits and gala events.
That's not a great time.
Well, they thought it was.
You want to have a great time? Let's go to the opera. Oh, my God.
You want to have a great time? Let's put on our PJs and watch Forensic Files.
Exactly.
That sounds like the best time.
I'm wearing my pheromone shirt and going clubbing. See ya.
No, you're not. Gross. Anyway, so Tom and Beth, you know, they would enjoy quiet time in her cottage. They would do the New York Times crossword puzzle together. They would enjoy fine dining and good wine. And you know, Tom could really keep up with Beth, and he knew about the finer things in life that Beth had at this point become well accustomed to. But, you know, let's all keep in mind that when Beth met Tom, he had been pretty much sober for like several months. So without the alcohol and all those empty beer calories, Tom had, you know, lost his beer belly, lost weight. His eyes no longer had that bloodshot, glassy gaze going on.
Yep.
And the author of Safe Haven talks about Tom kind of being a trophy boyfriend. Because remember, he's younger than Beth. But, you know, he could talk the talk, he could walk the walk, and he could easily fit into Beth's upper crust world. So for all intents and purposes, he really was a catch. And of course, Beth was truly a catch.
It sounds like Beth was way out of his league.
Oh, 100%. I mean, she was like an angel on earth. She sounds like one of the most kind and amazing humans.
It sucks to hear her fall in with somebody so shitty.
I know. I don't know how this like ever could have happened, but
rose-colored glasses.
It's true. Well, as I first mentioned, the first 4 weeks of Beth and Tom's relationship was an absolute whirlwind. I mean, they even met each other's parents like that quickly.
Wow.
So those 4 weeks were probably some of the happiest times in Beth's life. She felt like she finally had it all and believed she was really en route to her happily ever after. And the two of them actually did talk marriage, although it seems like Tom was the one who kind of brought it up and was pushing it. And Beth knew, though, that if she wanted to settle down and have a family, she needed to do it sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
But she's still like, okay, buddy, like, slow down a little bit.
For 1 month is this fast.
Yeah. But after those first 4 weeks of magic, things started to unravel.
As they do.
Yep. Beth began to see another side of Tom. Just like an ex-girlfriend had once said, he could be Jekyll and Hyde, which I said earlier. So one day, Beth was looking for something like in his room, and she came across a handgun that she had no idea that there was like a firearm in. And like, I think that he was at her house. So she was like, I didn't even know there's a gun in my home.
That's messed up. I feel like that's a conversation you should be having.
Yeah. And she was really taken aback and upset by it. And when she confronted him about it, he got angry and real nasty to her, telling her to mind her own business.
That should have been the moment right there. Like people who are afraid of guns and aren't around guns, like to find one in their home when they had no clue, that's dangerous.
That's
is what it
terrifying.
Is.
Yeah. So a few weeks into the relationship, Beth accompanied Tom to California. He claimed he had some investment meetings, although we don't really know what he was going there for. But Beth came with him as she had plenty of friends out there. So she got to meet up with her friends. She went surfing. She's just so cool. She just sounded like such a cool chick. So one night she met up with friends and she introduced them to Tom. And of course, they're so excited to meet this Mr. Perfect who, like, you know, swept their best friend like off her feet. So they went to dinner and it was okay. He was a little standoffish. They didn't feel warm and fuzzy about him. But when Tom and Beth were leaving dinner, he was like, oh, so like, what did they think of me? And, you know, Beth responds, oh, they thought you were charming, sophisticated, yada, yada. Tom proceeds to mutter under his breath, boy, I really should have been an actor.
That's those intrusive thoughts that we always tell people to keep inside your head.
Yeah, keep it in your head. Well, according to one of Beth's friends who, like, Beth had told about the comment later, it hit Beth like a punch to the gut. She would tell her friend that comment, like, gave her the creeps.
It's compounded with all the other stuff that's happening, too. Well, he's bringing guns. He's doing all these other things that are just, he's snapping for no reason. Like, these signs should be blatant by now.
And I think that they were, but, you know, she had everything except for love.
This happens all the time, I feel like. And that's why women are in these situations, because they maybe think it's all I can get at this point in my life, or it's good enough, or I can deal with this.
Right.
And then they just kind of let this stuff slide and it has bad outcomes.
Yeah, I totally agree. And this one is definitely the worst outcome. Well, that comment wasn't the only thing that turned Beth off of Tom. Tom just kept proposing to Beth and, you know, she kept saying, like, I need more time. Well, he just continued to pressure her, like, the whole trip in California. And they finally got into an argument about it. And Tom got really nasty and, like, yelled at Beth. And she later admitted to friends that he had really scared her. She ended up getting so fed up with his behavior that she just cut the trip short and returned home early. So I think at this point, friends were hoping that, like, this was the end of Beth and Tom. But just like he did with the other girlfriends, he love-bombed his way back into Beth's heart with flowers and gifts and, of course, promises that he didn't intend to keep. Later that week, Beth would take Tom to meet her brother, also named Tom. And this was a big deal. What? And this was a big deal because Beth and her siblings, she had three brothers and a sister, they were all incredibly tight. So, like, their opinion mattered a lot to her. So her brother Tom would later say that boyfriend Tom was pompous and a bit standoffish. But basically, like, he was coolly polite and seemingly normal. He just wasn't very pleasant. However, brother Tom did say that he left with an uneasy feeling in his stomach. He wasn't sure about the guy, and he felt that Beth's original excitement had dissolved, like, into something else. And
interesting.
Yeah, Tom was concerned. Like, all he wanted was for Beth to find someone who deserved and appreciated her.
Sure, I think that can be said for all of us. I think that's the ultimate goal, right?
Yeah. So after dinner with the brother, something inside Tom, boyfriend Tom, just snapped. And We don't know how long he had been drinking that day. Like, he drank a little bit at the restaurant at dinner, but not a ton. But he had been drinking, you know, pretty much all day. Mm-hmm. So when they left the restaurant, Beth and boyfriend Tom, they got into an argument on the cab ride home. And when the driver let them out, Tom put Beth in a headlock and started telling her he wanted to bash her head in.
What the hell?
Right? Like, Beth was shocked and absolutely terrified. She tried to leave immediately, but realized her cell phone and her Palm Pilot were up in his apartment. So she went up to get her belongings, and when she tried to leave, he wouldn't let her. He was drunk, he's ranting, he's raving. According to the Dateline episode, Tom did sexually assault Beth. And at this time, I think she was just so terrified of this man. So when he wanted to smooth things over, she just tried to stay on his good side.
I mean, at this point, that's all you can really do, you know?
Right.
Protect yourself.
Protect yourself. And that's what she was doing. So the following day, and now it's Friday, October 22nd, they went to the Met, which is the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And this is quite literally one of the most famous, most prestigious, and most like regal places in all of the world, possibly. So while they're viewing the art, Beth wandered over to this one painting, and it was kind of dark. And by dark, I mean like the colors, the images, the whole vibe was just dark.
Not the brightness, not how many lumens it was putting off.
No, zero lumens here. But Beth said that when she looked at that dark painting, she felt Tom. Like, that it just reminded her of him. And literally, as she's thinking this, Tom gets down on one knee in this super public place, and he proposes to Beth.
Was this like his idea of... I don't know. What a disaster, though. You know?
Like, such a disaster.
Knowing this guy's personality, too. Like, if she says no, I can't even imagine what's going to happen.
Well, I'm just about to say that, like, she's in shock and she's afraid of him. So she's like, tries to quietly tell him, like, I need more time.
Yeah.
And all, I'm sure, like, the whole place is staring because it's a public proposal, which I feel like he did to manipulate her.
Well, yeah, you put her in a position where she can't say no.
Exactly. Like, what, I mean, what would you even do? Oh. So she tells him, I need more time. And his response was, it's now or never. So Beth says, then it has to be never. And she turned to rush out. He begins losing his absolute shit.
She did the right thing, though.
I know. But, like, he's making a scene inside the Met. Like, wild. Like, he's chasing, he's yelling at her, like, they're running through the freaking Met of all places. Like,
there has to be video of this somewhere.
I'm sure that there is. I didn't even think about it, but... I don't know. We don't act like this at the Met.
No, this is why we can't go anywhere nice.
This is why we can't have nice things. So Beth finally gets outside and she quickly jumps into a cab. But of course, the cabbie has no sense of urgency and Tom jumps in the cab, continuing to just yell and berate her. So they get to Tom's apartment and he's like, I'm going to get hammered. I'm going to the bar. So Beth is like, cool, great, go to the bar. So she tries to sneak upstairs and get her belongings. He turns around, he realizes, and he follows her. He ends up essentially holding her captive. He went and laid down on top of her and passed out. So she's stuck underneath this 6-foot, 2-inch tall man. I don't know how much he weighed, but he was a big guy. I mean, she's stuck. Finally, at like 4 a.m, she's able to kind of wiggle her way out from underneath him. She didn't even want to use the elevator. She was so afraid that it would ding and wake him up. So she took the steps and she fled. She fled straight to LaGuardia Airport and hopped the first flight to Nantucket.
Good for her.
Yeah. Well,
get out.
Yes. At this point, she's done. She couldn't be with a man who treats her like this. So, you know, she decides to flee to her safe place. So after she landed in Nantucket, she didn't end up going to her cottage. She decided instead to go to her brother Peter's home. He had a home there with his wife and kids. And she's like, I'm going to stay there a couple nights. She just didn't want to be alone.
Yeah, fair.
And this is kind of interesting. Beth had, before she is murdered, she had told her sister one random night that her biggest fear was like being attacked when she was alone.
That's very ominous.
She had a couple instances that were almost like foreshadowing how her life was going to turn out. It was interesting. Yeah. But before she got to her brother Peter's house, she made one stop, and that was to the Nantucket Police Department. She asked the officer working at the desk, like, how would one go about obtaining an order of protection or a PFA? So the officer at the desk, you know, explained the process of obtaining a PFA, but Beth left without filling out any paperwork. And this would go on to really haunt the poor officer working at the desk. Like, he felt very guilty for not asking more questions, for not like pressing her a little bit further.
Yeah, and it's hindsight is obviously 20/20, but this is a great example of the collateral damage that comes from when someone is murdered. You know, obviously the victim suffers the most, but so does everybody around them, friends, family, loved ones. But even here, it's somebody that's not even like connected to the victim, only had a chance encounter. Just that one little decision, seemingly insignificant moment in this guy's life, is now led to a lifetime of regret. And I'm sure it bothers him every day, you know, so it's just sad all around.
It really is. Like, he had nothing to do with it, and yet it's probably going to be in his mind forever. Mm-hmm. Well, when Tom woke up that Saturday in his hungover stupor, he remembered the events from the night before, and when he realized Beth was gone, just like the anger from the night before came flooding back. He started calling her and calling her, and it ended up being that he called like over 50 times.
When you call somebody 50 times, like that's a different level. Like, I know people who are a little bit like that. And when things get crazy, like, and when they feel like they're out of control or they feel slighted, it's just like, call, call, call. It's like, you know, they're not going to answer, but you just keep, you're rage calling and you're rage texting. And then it goes into like this anger at this person for doing nothing except trying to get away from your crazy ass.
Yeah. Cause you're crazy.
Yeah.
Well, he continued to drink himself into a stupor that day.
Of course.
So the next day is Sunday, October 24th, and Tom's parents actually showed up to check on him, and they were like completely taken aback by his appearance. He was just a drunken disaster. And of course, after his parents left, he started drinking again.
Little hair of the dog.
Exactly. And he proceeded to go to his local pub and just get hammered. And he's just slamming back beers and shots of vodka. And he's getting angry again and angrier. And he's thinking, how dare she turn down his proposal? And how dare she leave him in the middle of the night? And of course, he knew that she would have fled to Nantucket. So we don't know a whole lot about Beth's movements on Sunday, October 24th, other than that she stayed at her brother's home and she hung out with her niece and nephew. We do know a pretty good amount about Tom's plans, though, because at trial, his movements for that entire weekend were like laid out and dissected. So he spent the afternoon drinking, and then he decides to head to LaGuardia Airport. He books a flight to Nantucket, Massachusetts, and he sets up a car rental for when he gets there. However, while in the security line, TSA finds an almost 12-inch knife that he had wrapped in a towel and put in his coat.
That was just a distraction. He was trying to get his big toothpaste through.
Yeah, right? Like, what a freaking idiot. So TSA like asked him, like, why do you have this? And there were several reasons that he gave.
You can
decide which one's your favorite.
Yeah.
He forgot he had it.
Oops.
He needed to cut a birthday cake.
I mean, you never know when there's going to be a knife.
It's true. So actually, you know what? It was to clean fish.
Oh, yeah. They don't, can't clean themselves.
Well, right. But you know what? Really, though, the truth, I'm going to tell you the truth this time. He needed to cut turkey with it.
Oh, I mean, some of those turkeys can be.
And TSA is basically like, you're an idiot. So they confiscate the knife. And of course, they have to check like his like name and everything on all these like terrorist watch group lists and stuff. But
well, because isn't this 04 too? Like right after, like not that long after 9/11
in New York. I know. So they take the knife, and Tom is given a summons to appear in court at some point down the road. So like yet again, it's like our boy gets a get out of jail free card.
This guy's a walking one.
Mm-hmm. So he ends up spending the night at the airport. So now it is the morning of Monday, October 25th. And yet again, we're back to the day we started. So that morning, Beth had offered to drop her niece and nephew off at daycare and to school. So after the two stops, you know, she left her brother's house, dropped them off, and she decided she was ready to start making her way back to the cottage on Hawthorne Lane. So she pulls in and she sees Barbara, the landlady, and the two women engaged in like friendly chit chat. And Beth made a comment to Barbara about how she was going to pick her nephew up from school, like right around 1:15. And she was really looking forward to it. Meanwhile, our boy got through TSA again with no knives on him. And he landed in Nantucket. And we have video footage of him getting off the airplane, going to the car rental desk, making his way out to the Red 4 Explorer, getting in, and driving away. So his first stop was to some sort of fishing bait and tackle store to pick up a 4-inch blade knife. He then drives to the two homes at 1 Hawthorne Lane, and this is exactly where we started with a New Yorker looking man asking Barbara if anyone was home at the rental cottage.
Wow.
So after that weird encounter, Barbara went inside her home to eat lunch. And this whole time she's feeling like something is wrong. So she's kind of, you know, looking out her window, and it's about 1 o'clock, and she realized that Beth's car is still in the driveway, and she's beginning to get concerned because remember, Beth was supposed to pick up her brother's kids, and like Barbara knew how much Beth loved those kids, and she was like excited to be on pickup duty. And then Barbara notices that all of the shades are drawn in the cottage. Yeah. And this is kind of when like all of the pieces start falling into place for Barbara. Like earlier that morning during their chit chat, Beth had like mentioned something about a breakup. And then Barbara had the encounter with the weird man who seemed to be looking for Beth. Mm-hmm. So Barbara begins calling Beth's phone, but there's no answer. And at this point, Barbara is super duper concerned, and she makes a decision to call Beth's brother, Peter. So she explains her concerns to Peter and the bad feeling she got from her encounter with the man in the red SUV. She's like, I don't feel good about this. Something's wrong. So Peter's standing there just clutching the phone to his ear. This pit begins forming in his stomach. He knows something is wrong. He tells Barbara, hang up, lock your doors, do not go outside. I'm calling the police.
She was supposed to leave and pick up my son at daycare. She won't answer her cell phone.
Okay, I'm going to send someone over right now.
Those feelings, I don't know, it's even scary in my imagination, and I can only imagine what it would feel like in a real life situation.
Yeah, you know what? I'm so just naturally anxious that like I feel like I don't know if I have those feelings. Or
how you feel when you
legitimate.
Wake up every day. Every day you have to go to work.
Pretty much.
Is it a work day? I feel nauseous and anxious.
So a short while later, it's around 1:15 p.m. and police arrive at the home on Hawthorne Lane. And, you know, they go up to Beth's cottage and they're knocking on the door. There's no answer. So one of the officers kind of is able to peer into one of the windows. And that's when he sees a woman lying on the floor in a pool of blood. So police get inside, like they break down the door. One clears the home while one tries to tend to Beth. But unfortunately, there was nothing that could be done for her. 44-year-old Elizabeth Lochtfeld was dead, having been stabbed 23 times.
Come on.
I know. And this is, remember I told you this was a 4-inch blade. That thing right up in someone's face.
Yeah, I mean that's tiny. It's like a pocket knife almost.
Yes.
Maybe a little bigger than a pocket knife, but that instantly should tell the police this was a personal attack. Because some of those wounds, especially if they were to her face, I obviously don't know where these 23 were, but I would assume that some were in the face.
Yeah.
And that's like a rage attack. Someone with a lot of hatred for the victim.
Well, so police begin to kind of put together a theory and, you know, they know it's Tom. Like, there's not really any kind of question. So they end up putting together a theory that, you know, she was working in her bedroom, which was like at the far end of the house. She was sitting at a desk and Tom sneaks in and he creeps through the house. And poor Beth was completely unaware that this monster is just like infesting her safe space. Like, we've talked about this before. The thought of someone being in your home that
with
like
your
shouldn't
stuff.
Be there. Oh, it's like. That's supposed to be, you're supposed to be able to shut that door and keep everything scary out.
Yeah, agreed.
So investigators hypothesized that Beth may have heard Tom at like the last moment and whirled around to be face to face with this man that for a moment she thought might be the one. So Beth is able to run and this woman fights like hell. Like she had brutal defense wounds all over her hands, her arms.
I feel bad for her because she did everything right. You know, she got away. She stayed a little longer than I would have, but I mean, she got away and it didn't matter.
Well, and here's the thing that I think is the biggest takeaway from this episode. Things like this don't generally happen to a woman like Beth. A smart, successful, like woman who went up against the mob and, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, how did she not see it? But I think it's so important to tell her story because this can happen to anyone.
She was blinded by the prospect of love. She's in her mid-40s. So she was like you said, it's now or never.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's the stage of life she was in. And that's how she was treating this relationship. Like she's going to try and stick it out as long as she could. But at some point, these things became too much. And she did realize like, you know what? True love is true love, but it's not with him.
It's definitely not with him. Yeah. So when police inspected Beth's body, they were disgusted to see what Tom had left at the scene. He had placed a dildo and lube on top of Beth's bloodied body, and then he sprinkled marijuana all over her corpse.
Some killers will desecrate a body to just throw off the investigation, you know, try to like point police in a different way. But I don't believe that's even close to what was happening here. I think this guy was so embarrassed and hurt and his little baby ego was just so destroyed that he turned her into a sideshow attraction for like something. Yeah, one of those things you just can't look away from because he wanted her to feel embarrassed like he did.
Yep. It's so sick. Like, it's just so like adding like insult to injury, you know?
It's evil. It's pure evil.
Absolutely. Well, after that, he went back to her bedroom to steal her cell phone and her Palm Pilot. He then walked back through the home. He stepped over Beth's bloody and mutilated body. He walked out the door and he left. So police speak to Barbara first, and, you know, she told them about the man and the Red 4 Explorers. She also explained, you know, that she had just spoken to Beth and nothing seemed to be really wrong except for the breakup. And, you know, police also talked to her parents and her brother, and that's when they were able to put together that the killer was most likely Tom Toolbag Tool. So Tom had already fled at this point. He took a flight from Nantucket back to Hyannis, Massachusetts, where he rented another car. This time it was a gray Chevy Impala. So once police were able to like figure this out, they put out an all points bulletin and APB. And just a few hours later, authorities in Rhode Island spotted the vehicle and pulled Tom over for driving under the influence. when he was breathalyzed, he was 2 times over the legal limit. And then later in court, both sides had experts who said the opposite of what the other expert said. Mm-hmm. But the one guy would say that at the time of the murder, his blood alcohol level was 0.30.
Given how much he drinks on a daily basis, that checks out.
That's the thing. Like, you or I, we'd be like dead. But for him, it's like a normal Tuesday, you know, like it's not.
Yeah.
Well, Tom was arrested for drunk driving. And oh, my God, he's so annoying. The whole time he's like, officer, what is this about? What is this about?
Oh, shocker. He's denying it. Yeah,
of course. Well, Tom is sitting in the drunk tank in Rhode Island. Officers had impounded both rental cars, both of which had Beth's blood in them, along with his bloody clothes in one of them. And I will say the murder weapon was never found. Police think that he probably threw it out the window while driving away from the crime scene. So he's arrested, and then his trial begins on June 4th, 2007. So, like 3 years after the murder. And this trial lasted about 3 weeks. Prior to the start of the trial, the defense team had pushed really hard to get the trial moved and relocated, like, off of Nantucket.
Yeah, where they wouldn't just completely bash this guy.
Yeah, and like, I do see their point. Like, this is a relatively small community, and this murder had literally made the cover of People magazine, so everybody knew.
It's probably the murder that happens there in decades.
Well, it is. It's the first one in like 25 years or something crazy. But the judge was like, ooh, let me think about. No. So he made them stay in Nantucket. So trial starts, and the defense's argument about the murder was basically trying to use the good old insanity defense, or I should say lack of criminal responsibility. Diminished capacity.
Yeah.
So there was an article written by the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and they talk about his lawyer, Kevin Reddington, who claimed that Tulum was involuntarily intoxicated through, quote, a combination of his mental and emotional condition, ingestion of alcohol, and consumption of prescription and non-prescription medications at the time of the slaying. End quote. To which I say, shut the hell up. Like, this guy knew what he was doing. No one forced that shit down his throat. Like,
yeah, he knew what he was doing. And with the amount of overkill that existed in this case, he was ready to end her and humiliate her. This was a pre-planned, premeditated event. No doubt.
Exactly. And
dude was trying to bring a knife to, like, on the flight to get there. He brought everything he needed.
And the prosecution did a great job of proving that, like showing the jury that the argument was crap and this was a cold and calculated murder. He went to the airport with a knife the night before. He came back, he stayed at the airport that entire night. He flew to Nantucket. He rented the car. He went and he bought the knife. He drove the car to Beth. Like, there's just so much time for him to stop and think, but he didn't. So after the couple of weeks on Thursday, June 21st, 2007, it took the jury less than 4 hours to LWOP that bitch.
Boom.
As Ann Rule would say, LWOP. Life without parole. So he was guilty of first degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But as we all know, the first degree murder cases get like a billion appeals.
At least a billion.
At least. And I get it. And I think everyone else will get it when we get to our it definitely wasn't me exonerations block, which will probably be at the end of this year, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Give or take.
Well, unfortunately for the world, in 2011, the conviction was reversed.
Why?
Basically because of impartial jury selection and the fact that they did it in Nantucket and not somewhere else.
But that all should be addressed before it's in Nantucket. And I felt like it was. Whatever.
I know. Well, in June of 13, the retrial started. This time it was in Barnstable, Massachusetts, which really isn't that far, but whatever.
Yeah, what's up there?
Yeah. And Tom's defense was kind of similar with the whole insanity, mentally impaired nonsense, but This time the defense attorney came out and admitted, well, yeah, he killed her, but he'd been doing drugs and drinking since he was like 13, and that totally left him mentally impaired. So totally not his fault, guys.
That's what they do. Grasp at straws. What straws can we grasp at? Because it's so blatantly obvious the guy did it.
100%. And like in the first trial, the lawyer never really came out and said he did it. He kind of alluded to it. But this guy was like, yeah, he did it. But yeah.
It's on their only hope.
Right. Well, the prosecutor had a ton of witnesses who said, you know, Thomas was behaving completely sane and lucid in the hours leading up to the murder. Airport security said that he smelled like he had been drinking like the night before, but otherwise he was fine. And the car rental worker, the guy who sold him the knives, like everybody said again, no, he was fine. He didn't seem drunk or out of his mind. And evidently, the jury did agree with everyone. You know, they agreed with the defense. Yeah, Tom did kill Beth. And they also agreed with the prosecution that he was in full control of his mental faculties.
Good.
So Tom was yet again found guilty. He has tried to appeal a third time, but in 2022, the court reaffirmed his guilty verdict. So he is in prison.
Sorry.
Yeah, but not.
Don't kill people.
Exactly. But that is the incredible romance fail and murder of Beth Lochtfeld.
God, poor Beth. It's so tragic. It's kind of that lesson in the whole story that money can't buy happiness. Because Beth really had everything, it seemed like to me, except for a good man, you know, and she really did try to make it work at every turn, even plenty of times where I would have just, but again, I'm on the outside going, it's easy for me to say I would have left at that when he did that or did that. So I don't know. She tried.
It's just an eye opener that this kind of situation, anyone can get into it, regardless of how much money you have, what you do.
The heart is a funny thing. It makes you do stuff you don't think you would ever do, but you do. Well, that does it for February, for the month of love, and for our block fairy tale or romance fail. So next month, though, we have some pretty cool stuff and a little bit different. We thought we would call next month's block March Madness, a nod to the NCAA basketball tournament, the college basketball, the brackets that you see going around for all our non-sports fans. That's the March Madness brackets. But these will all be sports murders. They're not going to be one sport specifically, just kind of murders in the world of sports and how it affected communities, high schools, universities, the sports world. And hopefully most of you will have been following us on socials because we posted the other day discussing how April is going to be called spring cleaning, the April block.
That's right. And we're going to be cleaning out our inbox, but and covering cases that you guys want us to cover. So please send us your suggestions. You can DM us. You can email us. So DM us on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, @MurderUnscripted. You can email us, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can send us a note through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
And while you're at it, like, subscribe, comment, review, anything would be greatly appreciated. We love interacting with you guys, and it helps us so much, helps us continue to grow and bring this stuff to you.
That it does. Well, that is all we have for you today. Stay safe, be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
I feel like this guy's sign would have some flair to it. Maybe some rhinestones.
Oh, absolutely. But I feel like it would be gold, but it would also turn your hands green.
Cheap gold.
Bye.
Yeah.